Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to take us to the community level and out of the health clinic. So we are a small nonprofit organization that works in public housing development, and our mission is basically organizing advocacy and environmental justice. Thank you. So what do? We do several things, and I just grouped them into a couple of things. We do tenant organizing, where we actually go into the community and organize residents around policy issues. We do tenant advocacy, where we help connect residents who live in public housing to services that they need, and that includes asthma education. Many of our work focuses on environmental justice education and advocacy around co-violations in the home that could lead to certain health disparities. And we also do tenant leadership, where we actually go into the community and organize tenants to empower themselves to be able to deal with their own issues. So we do tenant, what they call local tenant task forces, we do committees, and we build coalitions. So who's our population? We work only in the Boston public housing developments. We have close to 24,000 to 26,000 public housing tenants. The majority live well below the poverty line. They are single head of household females. We have a lot of first-generation immigrants. They're linguistically diverse. We currently documented 13 different languages spoken. And within those culturally diverse, we also have, for example, Latinos. We have Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, we have South Americans. What they all have in common is that they all have health disparities. So how do we reach out? There's several ways that we reach out. So the first one that I like to talk about is what we call our peer recruitment and education. One of the models that we find most successful is actually hiring people from the community who are from the community or formerly from that community. And the reason why we do this is because they could identify with the issues that people are experiencing. How do we do this? How do we go out and recruit people from the community or formerly from the community? We actually physically go up and down the stairs. There's 11,000 units. We primarily focus on 24 family public housing developments. And we do door-on-door recruitment, where we actually place a leaflet under each door. And we specify what we're looking for. So, for example, if we're looking for a community health advocate, we specify what languages we want. So if we want someone who speaks Chinese, we put that on the flyer. If we're looking for someone who we want is Haitian Creole, we put that on the flyer. We also specify the level of recruitment that we want. So if we want someone who's going to be doing in-house education, we put down, must be able to walk 3 flights of stairs for 6 hours. That's really important. Another way that we recruit people is that we attend community meetings or coalition meetings within that community. That helps us. Sometimes when we go into those communities, we can identify who are the leaders, and because leaders are more likely to attend community meetings or be running them or be part of coalitions. And if we can't recruit, steal them away from the coalitions, then we ask them, do you know anyone else in your neighborhood who could get? We stipend members of the community. We find that it's better to rather than use expensive translators to do some of our leaflets, that it's easier just to translate, to have someone from that community to translate our material for us. We also test language skills. Sometimes we find that not everybody in the community could do oral translations or could write a leaflet. So we test them. We actually have them read something to us. So if I'm looking for someone to translate in Spanish, I have them read that material in Spanish to me. If they could translate it word for word, then I know I could use them to stand up here and translate. If they can't do that, then I know I could just use them for the door knocking. How do we identify potential volunteers to help them determine what is the best time? Sometimes we go into one community and we realize when we're doing a night meeting that might not be the appropriate time to go in there and do education in that particular community. For example, we went into one community, we found out that mostly everybody in that community works a 6 o'clock schedule to the following day. And we were hosting on night meetings, it wasn't successful. So when we went into a couple of coalition meetings and spoke to the leaders, they told us it's best to have mid-afternoons, late-afternoon meetings if you want to reach our population. We also train all of our staff and our volunteers in multidisciplinary related fields. For example, when we in our asthma education, we also like to train them in other related fields such as lead prevention, child injury prevention, healthcare access, because we find that when you go into a particular home, this, you're not dealing with just one issue, you're dealing with a variety of issues. So we cannot do our asthma education if someone's hungry in that home. Getting them to the food pantry becomes a priority. We also host our trainings and meetings in the language preferred in that community. A lot of times, we'll go into a community, people might speak English, but doesn't mean they prefer for us to host that community meeting in English. If their preference might be Spanish, their preference might be Chinese, so we tend to host language-specific meetings. We won't do it in English. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. We also, we go in and we identify the most common languages. When we do our outreach materials, we try to do it in the three most common languages. All of our materials at fifth grade level, two reasons. I don't know what's happening. Only because it's easier, our illiteracy level is fifth grade. We have a lot of high school dropouts, but also it makes it easier for translation. We find that, and we tend to use words that could be translated very easily. For instance, the word conversation is not very easily translated into other languages, but the word speak is. We try not to use many words. We try to use pictures. For instance, the pictures in the bottoms, we try to say, don't use pesticides. So we put that picture there to have an impact, and people are more likely to ask questions. How do you pay for this material is often the question that a lot of people have. So I'd like to talk a little about the collaboration that we use. In-house, we use, as I said it before, we tend to use community people. We stipend them. For instance, if we wanted to translate something in Russian, it could run up to $1,500, as opposed to me paying a community person $500 to translate it. And the reason they're more likely to translate it is because they have a personal investment for the community. When we're writing our grants, one of the things that many of us forget to do is write it into our grants, a translation line or a recruitment process. We tend to write it right in and specify to the funder that we're going to use the funding for this. We also collaborate with a lot of other agencies, and not to reinvent the wheel. So we actually seek out other agencies' materials, and we ask permission to use it. And we also negotiate with other nonprofit agencies who have similar missions to negotiate responsibilities. So, for instance, I might do the translation because we have the in-house ability, because my staff speaks different languages, but they might have the ability to reproduce it. And so we negotiate responsibilities that way. Thank you. So now I want to talk a little bit of collaborations, which is one of our most successful things that we do at a particular agency. One of the things that we tend to do, and I spoke a little bit about the first one, so I'll move into this second one, we write each other into grants. For example, currently in dealing with the asthma epidemic in Massachusetts in New England that's growing, we have started coalitions, and one of the things that we have done is there's 11 of us in nonprofit agencies working together, where we tend to take different parts of the city of Boston. We're all working and trying with the affordable housing movement that they're building and trying to build healthier green housing that could improve asthmatic families. And so we work around the issue. We actually attack developers into trying to make sure they use healthy materials, have carpet-free, smoke-free, and also good ventilation systems that these families really need. We also reach out to health centers for their materials. A lot of health centers actually reach out to us to put out their materials, so we negotiate some of the materials that way. And the other thing that we do is we actually work with the Boston Public Health Commission. A lot of the times we find that health commissions actually seek out community people because they have to make appropriate language materials to reach to populations. And so we don't have to incur that cost. The health commission incurs that cost. We do the focus groups for them. They actually pay us to do those focus groups. And in turn, we get to use their materials. For example, this is something that the public housing residents actually participated in focus groups, actually sat with series of meetings, were actually paid to participate in those meetings, and then they created 9 different languages, and this is basically what they call the integrated pest management. It talks about what things they could do in their homes to prevent pests from coming in or eliminate some of the pest problems they have. And then they could also share it with the other neighbors. And then the fifth point that I want to make is about participating with local universities. Now, this is a really tricky one for us. we are finding that within our neighborhoods, there's a lot of research going on. And because we are an organizing agency, we like to protect the rights of our tenants. And so what we tend to do is when we know this research going on, we like to approach some of these academics and basically say, if you're coming into our neighborhoods to do research, we want to benefit from it. And because we have an excellent recruitment process, we basically negotiate with them to say, we want to do the recruitment process for you. We're capable, and we want to train our tenants to recruit their own neighbors. And so we actually develop a peer-on-peer module to do this, and we negotiate the cost, and we negotiate what languages we want to translate and how this is going to be done. And for the most part, most academics are willing to do that. We also negotiate a little bit of more long-term jobs. And so one of the things that we tend to tell them is, if you're going to be in our neighborhoods, we want some jobs for our tenants. And so they actually hire our tenants to do some of the data collection. It's tricky because when you're not providing programs, which is really what their basis is, but we also trying to negotiate that towards the end of the study, we want some type of policy and something that comes out of it. And so that's what we get from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Edna. Our next speaker is Linnea. She'll have to tell you her last name. She is a legislative research associate with the Maya Tech Corporation in Silver Spring, Maryland. Maya Tech is a corporation has provided support for the National Cancer Institute's State Cancer Legislative Database Program for more than 15 years. Ms.